Hi, and welcome to Screening Room with Chet and Dee. I am Chet.
And I'm Dee.
I'm a boomer.
And I'm a millennial, and we both love classic movies.
And we think you're going to love them, too, if you give them a shot.
Which is where we come in.
We're here to talk about those old movies. We tell you why we think they're so good, we give you a little background about how they're made.
And we'll also talk about what those movies can teach us. About history, about people.
And maybe even about the meaning of life. Good movies try to do that.
And that's why we want you to watch them. You're welcome.
Yes.
But before we get into today's movie choice.
Yes.
We need to talk about our sponsors, which are not actually our sponsors. We just feel like giving them a major shout out.
Yeah. And we're doing this for free. It's gratis.
Pro bono.
Pro bono. Yeah.
Because we're really doing God's work here. So, Pets for Refugees and this old cat house.
Yeah. Couple of not-for-profit, do-gooder organizations in Rochester. With the Pets for Refugees, I assume, what, they get pets?
For refugees.
For refugees.
Yes. So, they subsidize the care for refugees to adopt pets. You can buy two discarded people and animals and
put them together.
Companionship.
Yeah.
It's like how a good movie makes you feel.
What a lovely idea. And then this old cat house is an old house for old cats.
But really, it's like the youngest cats in the world because they foster neonatal kittens mostly.
That's right. That's
so round the clock bottle feeding. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We got Ruthie, Baby, and Ginzy. I mean, they do right now, and they'll be ready for adoption soon. But
enough about them because they're not paying us anything to do this.
No. But you know what is paying to be alive right now?
What
having an 81-degree day on November 10th.
That's right.
In 2020.
Yeah. We're going to be having picnics for Thanksgiving, I can tell already.
With our tofurkey.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yes, but, okay,
who needs to worry about social distancing when you have the turkey or approximation in a picnic setting on the beach? Yeah. Anyway.
Lake Ontario.
Not that that matters at all.
But what's tomorrow?
Tomorrow is November 11th. And that's a special day for this country.
It's Veterans Day.
It's Veterans Day.
And so we chose
a veterans movie.
And it's
What? It's
best years of our lives.
It's the best years of our
1946.
And this is one of the best movies of our lives. This you're talking about the best years of our lives. Produced by Samuel Goldwyn, directed by William Wyler, starring
Myrtle freaking Lloyd
and Frederick March in the lead roles,
and Dana Andrews. Also, when did they start changing it to where Danas were females?
I don't know when they did. Maybe.
Like, I would not have guessed because I grew up knowing a Dana female, so it's like when I hear Dana male.
Dana.
Not that I care about gender.
Dana Carvey is a male.
I wouldn't have known. Who's that?
Dana Carvey's a comedian. He was on.
Not very funny, I guess. So I
it can
no,
go
so,
both
okay,
ways.
Okay, well, anyway, okay. I find that interesting. Okay, Teresa
okay.
Wright.
Teresa
Never
Wright.
Wrong.
Virginia Mayo. Hoagie Carmichael.
We don't need to mention
just
Mayo.
Stars and stars and stars. And fantastic performances. And this movie, it wins the Oscar for Best Picture that
best
year.
Best actor,
best,
Frederick March.
Best director.
Best supporting actor.
Best supporting actor.
Harold Russell.
Best
sound.
Best musical score.
Best editing.
Yeah, just best of years.
Best of the eight.
The best of the years of our lives. It's a fantastic, fantastic movie, and it's part of the reason people love this movie so much is because it deals so honestly, so forthrightly, so dramatically, so tenderly with the subject of veterans coming home from World War II, and it talks about how difficult it is for them to readjust to civilian life, how difficult it is to readjust to being parts of their families, how hard it is for them to either find jobs or go back to their old jobs and find any meaning in those experiences, how hard it is to keep a marriage together, how hard it is to relate to your children, how hard it is to deal with things like substance abuse. It's really just an incredible film.
That can be really important to watch today.
Yeah, you can watch this film today and see at the time this was made, nobody really even thought all that much about veterans. I mean,
well,
they didn't want
to do these kinds of movies because people wanted escapists.
Yeah, the war was so terrible. Why should we think about that anymore? Let's just get on with our lives. And that's part of the reason that it's so hard to come back from the war as a veteran because nobody wants to talk about the war anymore.
It's kind of like today where we don't want to talk about sad stuff or...
Yeah.
Like PTSD even today. I mean, it's more not as taboo to talk about it, but we just, especially with the year 2020, people are over being depressed.
Let's just get on with it. But I mean, just
not
think
of, even thinking about troops in Afghanistan and...
Yes, we're still at war in Afghanistan. And it's like half the country doesn't even know we're still at war. But we are. And yeah, in 1946, or, you know, 45 when they first start making this movie, yeah, everybody knew about the war, but it's like, let's get on with things. And if you just stop and think about it, these people coming back from combat experiences, every second of every day was about staying alive. They had to kill other people. They had to see their comrades die around them. They had to deal with their own physical wounds. They had to deal with the stress and trauma. As you said, we didn't have the term PTSD, but clearly it existed at the time. And how do you cope with that? How do you somehow piece your life back together? That's what this movie is all about.
And what is more of like it hits at home for me is my grandpa served in World War II.
Yeah. Oh,
Arthur
did he?
Lyndon. Yeah, so...
Did he ever serve?
But he did not talk about it to my mom at all. So what we have for record of what he did was talking to local journalists or something. Like, my great uncle also served, and we'll talk about him when we talk more about Harold Russell.
Yeah, I know you've talked about your grandfather before, and one of the things that I found fascinating was in your family, it's like your family heard about his wartime experiences, and which includes the D-Day invasion of Normandy, the Battle of the Bulge.
He was a sergeant leader, squad leader of the 90th Infantry Division anti-tank unit in the worst fighting of the European theater during World War II. He survived D-Day invasion, the Battle of the Bulge, victories at the Maginot and Siegfried lines. He was wounded three times and fought through an appendicitis flare-up while under enemy fire. He and his comrades took 20 Germans prisoner after the Germans stumbled into my grandfather's foxhole in the middle of the night. He saw dozens of his friends die beside him during his 3 years in Europe, and he saw too many casualties on both sides of the line to count. So there's...
Well, that was really...
He came
really
back
well
to Nebraska.
Written, that account. Right.
Very well written.
Yeah.
But he did not share his war stories. He did bring back... So there's a point where Al gives his son some Japanese weapons. My grandfather did bring back German weapons, and I know that my uncle... I remember my grandma kept them under her bed, but nobody talked about them.
Yeah.
Because he passed when I was one. He passed actually around Veterans Day. They couldn't have his funeral on the 11th, so they had it on the 12th. But I really wish my grandpa would... I don't know if he saw this movie.
Yeah.
That's why I brought him up, is I wish he would have seen it. My mom hasn't seen it, so I'm going to have her watch it, because I just know she will love it.
How has your mother not seen this movie?
I don't know.
What has she been doing with her
life? They re-released this movie a few times, so I'm not sure. Because she wasn't born when this was out, but...
Yeah.
But anyway, they don't...
Interesting. You talked about your grandfather, and yeah, we know all this stuff about his service, but only because some newspaper reporter interviewed him.
Yeah, otherwise I wouldn't have realized how... I wouldn't have needed him to have all that to be. Like, my grandpa is a hero to me, but it's... reading it today hits a different way.
And I would just suspect, I don't know for a fact, you know, the situation with your family, but I would just suspect it was somewhat like in this film where the veterans come home and the family is all there, and it's like, we know that our loved one, that we know that our husband, son, father...
Well, I don't think my grandpa was with my grandma yet, actually.
Okay.
Because my mom was born in 1952. Lois is a couple years older than
that. That would have been a very long gestation period, so probably not.
But his parents were immigrants from Sweden, so I'm not sure how much they would have been able to get out of make him talk.
But I still have a brilliant and insightful point here.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Which is that these men come back, and the people who are closest to them, they understand that they've been through these terrible, horrific, incredibly important experiences, but they don't know how to talk about them. And they can't decide, does he want to talk about what happened in the war, or does he want to talk about anything but what happened in the war? Do we just pretend that it never happened, or do we invite him to talk? Do we listen? Do we whatever? They don't know. The veterans come back, and they can talk maybe with some other veterans about what happened, or a stranger about what happened, but you don't want to unburden that on your family and just have it hang in the air so that every time you see them from now on, they're going to be thinking, oh, is he thinking about that time in the war when somebody died right beside him or what have you. So they keep that inside and they have to figure out, how do I deal with this? And that's what happens in this movie. Or variations of that, lots of things. Okay, we should talk about what actually happens in this movie.
All right, so the movie follows three returning veterans.
Yeah, and there are three...
three different sides of the tracks.
Yeah.
Different upbringings.
So we got, first of all, we got Al. Frederick March plays Al Stevenson, and he was a banker before the war and had a cushy job, and he was like maybe late 30s, or he's maybe about 40 or so when he comes home, so he would have been an older serviceman. But this banker gets drafted into the infantry. He becomes a sergeant. He fights in the Pacific, some really hellish, like hand-to-hand combat kind of stuff. And after that, he's got to come back and decide, do I go back to work in a bank and wear a suit? And he says at one point in the movie, it's like yesterday it was kill Japs and today it's make money. And what an incredibly paradoxical combination of things to happen in one lifetime in a matter of months. These are the things that you're worried about. This is what's important in life. Which of these is real? Which of these is the illusion? So, that's Al.
And then we have Fred.
Fred, the bomber. We find out that Fred...
Dana
Andrews, handsome leading man. Dana Andrews plays Fred. And he was a bombardier in the... It actually wasn't the Air Force yet. It was the Army Air Corps. Later became the Air Force. But he was dropping bombs on German cities. And he was actually a highly decorated captain. We find out eventually that he was quite heroic and decorated for his valor. And he also saw terrible combat. Saw people die around him. Planes shot down. Had to bailout, all that kind of stuff. He's got nightmares from the whole thing. But before the war, he was this poor kid growing up on the wrong side of town, working as a soda jerk. Now he's coming back, and it's like he's proven himself. He's served incredibly valiantly, and now he comes back and everybody's like, well, who cares? What good is that experience for? I guess if you want to be a soda jerk again, you can be a soda jerk again. You do know what a soda jerk is, right?
I'm not that young to where I don't know what a soda jerk is.
Oh, really? What is a soda jerk?
It's a jerk that made it to where Americans wanted sweet stuff, so that's why we have an obesity problem.
You would get your soda.
Because you put soda with ice cream, and you get whipped cream and cherry on top and toppings, and so a soda jerk is a jerk because he knows what he did.
That's right. Yeah. And this was
But it's really cool. It's if you watch Gilmore Girls, Taylor opens a soda shop in Stars Hollow, so... For the young people.
That's right. And because your drugstore had a counter where they served sandwiches and sodas. This is before you had fast food restaurants. We don't have a McDonald's yet. If you want fast food, you go to the corner drugstore and you get a sandwich and a soda to go with it. Anyway, that's Fred. Okay. And then our third veteran is Homer. Homer Parrish, who was in the Navy.
Played by Harold Russell.
And, incredible story here because, the character, Homer Parrish, serves in the Navy, and his ship gets torpedoed, and there's this terrible fire, and he has to have his hands amputated. And he comes back, and he's wearing these prosthetic hooks. And, of course, Homer Parrish, you said, is played by Harold Russell.
And Harold Russell actually is disabled, so this was an authentic person playing Homer, which in today's standards is amazing because there is not enough disabled representation on the screen. They get an able-bodied person to play a person that has a disability. So in 1946, they actually get some major props for having giving a role to someone who is disabled.
Yeah, yeah. Today you'd get an able-bodied actor and you'd
use some CGI.
Yeah, and he'd say, "Oh, how cool it is!"
And he'd probably win an award.
Yeah, that looks so realistic. But or in the old days, you wouldn't get a disabled person and you just fake it, and it would be so phony that you could tell. But no, this guy, Harold Russell, actually he had lost his hands. He was in the Army, and it was in a training accident. He was showing people how to use explosives, and the explosives go off, and he loses both of his hands. And William Wyler actually sees him in this short film about veterans who are coping with physical disabilities, and he has a pretty extended scene in that, and he says, "I want this guy for my movie," and that's what we're going to deal with in this movie. He's coming back. He's a young guy from a middle-class family, and he was a star athlete in high school, and he's still quite young. He must have gone into the service like right out of high school, and now he's coming back, and he's got a girlfriend, a sweetheart that he was promised to marry, the girl next door, and it's like everything is different, and he has to figure out what do I do now. It's like and he's trying to tell his girlfriend, Wilma, "Look, you don't want to be with me anymore. I can understand." And so he actually avoids her.
But she is, "I'm sorry, Homer, but you don't get to make the decision of whether I can handle this or not."
That's right.
Which is also really progressive for them to do.
Yeah.
Because she could go marry somebody, a man that has two jobs that could provide very well for her.
Yeah, and the women in this film,
they actually want love.
Yeah.
Except for Virginia Mayo, which, I mean, that's why most of us prefer Miracle Whip.
That's right. But no, we've got the three veterans coming back, and for the most part, the other men in this film, aside from, we should mention, Hoagie Carmichael, Homer's has got an uncle that owns a bar, and his name is Butch, and he's played by Hoagie Carmichael, who's a composer, and he is like the one guy who kind of seems to understand what Homer is going through and can actually talk to him about it. Other than that, most of the men in this film who are not veterans don't get it, never come close to getting it, and in some cases, we're even going to find one really small character who was part of probably the America First movement that opposed the war, said we shouldn't get involved in it, we had thousands of people even before the war started that were pro-Nazi in this country and certainly didn't want us to go to war with Germany.
Yeah, so when you're saying that they don't want to go to war, it's not to where it's, I don't want war, I want peace. It's not our problem.
Yeah, democracy isn't all that great. You know, America First just means we stay out of the world's business, and what's wrong with the Nazis anyway? They seem like fine people, and yada, yada, yada. And that's another thing that's really interesting about this film is all the films that are made during the war, if that's all you ever watched, you would get the impression that 100% of Americans from day one or even before day one were all in this and were willing to make whatever sacrifice was necessary. And that wasn't necessarily the case. We didn't necessarily want to get into the war, and not everybody was supportive of it.
Well, I was really surprised when they come back and Fred's looking for a job that he's not able to get anything other than a soda jerk position.
Yeah, because nobody cares. Nobody was impressed.
Back then, they were more. They better accommodated veterans by.
Yeah, and some of the guys who didn't serve are like, oh yeah, they get to come back and take our jobs now. We're supposed to make a big deal about the fact that they went off and saved the world.
Yeah, well, I was really surprised by that.
Yeah, but again, a really honest depiction of a full scope, nuanced views of how people approach the war and veterans' issues after the war. So what did we say? Okay, we talked about our three veterans. So what happens is that they all come home, and first, they get together. They just by happenstance, they're all trying to get back to their hometown, fictional Boone City, Middle America, and the only flight that they can get home is this retired bomber that's being flown to some airfield somewhere, and they get to fly along, and they literally look at their hometown from the nose of the bomb site, from the nose cone of the plane. And they see, and they can, they're looking at this town, and they're just seeing everything is happening, and they just know, my gosh, life went on. We were involved in these life and death issues. Everything was immediate. Everything was, all you care about are the people around you, that your comrades in arms. All you cared about was somehow surviving the day, and here these people are going to the store and playing golf and going to school and all that kind of stuff, and their lives went on without us, and how the heck are we ever going to get back and integrate it into this? And they're literally just watching this play out like a movie underneath them as they're flying back home. So from the get-go, we get just beautiful storytelling, and we get this sense of how awkward and nervous these guys are about coming home.
Yeah, they're nervous. They want to keep on putting that off.
Yeah. Oh, then okay. So we talk. Al comes home. So.
Tearjerker, misty eye.
Yeah.
Surprises.
Did you already say who Al's wife is?
Myrna Loy.
Oh, the
Minnie.
Millie.
Millie. Oh my gosh.
The incomparable Millie. Myrna Loy.
Now we're gonna get Millie. We got it.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, their reunion is just...
America's wife.
Yeah. You just see immediately that there's this nervousness on both sides. They've been separated for 4 years. How do we get this marriage back together? And Al is concerned because he knows that he's been changed, and his kids have grown up, literally grown up.
Yeah, his kids asking him questions about the war that he doesn't have the answers to or doesn't know if he likes the answers he has to give.
Yeah, I mean, his son has been learning about...
Have the Japanese been treated okay?
Yeah, and it's like, well, what about this, what about nuclear warfare and all this kind of stuff? And Al is like, yeah, that's a pretty good question. The next war probably isn't going to be like this, is it? His daughter has been working in a hospital, and she's now a young woman, and she's just wise beyond her year. Oh,
Teresa Wright.
Teresa
plays Peggy Stevens.
Fantastic actress, Teresa Wright. Anyway, so Al gets back together with his wife, and they're just so nervous. On the one hand, they're overjoyed to see each other, but at the same time, it's like I don't know how to be with you anymore, and do you even need me anymore? And this movie does actually a really good job of handling an incredibly touchy subject. Sexual relations in this movie.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about, where we can't touch each other right now is COVID?
No.
Okay.
Wasn't going to talk about that. But even though this is 1946 and you can't be, you can't have, sex scenes in movies, we're talking about this, or at least implicitly, and part of what we have to deal with is Al sees his wife again, and he is so nervous to be around her. You think that they're going to have this, the kids are going to leave him alone, and they're going to just go right at it immediately, but no, Al is so nervous, it's like, let's go out on the town and celebrate, and let's go get drunk off my butt, because I'm not quite sure how to deal with this. And so they go out, and they do a bar crawl. And eventually they end up back at Butch's, and they meet up with Homer and with Fred again. And Fred is having an even harder time.
He can't find his wife.
Yeah.
Kind of hard. He's working at the club, so he's there. He's drunk. Homer leaves home because his family is too sympathetic for him. And he's finally legal to have a drink. Before he left, he wasn't.
Yeah.
But his uncle must know that since Homer is in such a state to where maybe he shouldn't have hard liquor.
Yeah.
He's like, no, you can only have beer.
Yeah.
I think he kind of saved Homer a lifetime of addiction by making it to where he could only have beer. Because obviously he could drown him, he could self-medicate.
Yeah.
With what he's wanting to not deal with.
And
or he's dealing with it, but...
And Al, we even by the time the movie ends, Al is still struggling a little bit with... I mean, he gets blitzed this first night, and he is going to keep drinking quite a bit throughout this. And, God, this movie does such a wonderful job. On the one hand, when these guys are out together, and when Al and Fred are just stupid drunk and passed out and not even sure where they're at, on the one hand, it's funny... But at the same time, you see by the expressions of the faces of Millie and Peggy that they're also concerned about these men. And they're concerned about the fact that they understand they're using alcohol as a way to escape dealing with the hard stuff that's ahead for them. And Al's going to continue to have problems with alcohol. He's going to go back to his job at the bank, and he's going to be asked now to decide who gets GI Bill back loans and who doesn't, and worry about money. And part of the way he's going to cope with that is to keep self-medicating throughout that whole experience. So, again, just a really... nuanced and mature discussion of the role of alcohol in people's lives as something that they use to cope with difficulties. Okay, we should say more about Fred. Fred and his wife, his wife is Marie, played by Virginia Mayo, and they had this whirlwind romance, and quickly that marriage starts to fall apart because she doesn't want to live on his cruddy salary. He has to go back to work as a soda jerk in the drugstore. She wants to keep partying. She wants to keep seeing other men, which clearly she was doing all the whole time that he was gone. So that marriage starts to fall apart, but he's still married, and he's attracted to Peggy, and she's attracted to him, and this becomes kind of a love triangle, and Al has to step in, and even though Al really likes Fred, he's got to have this scene where he tells Fred, you need to stay away from my daughter because, you know, you're a married man, and I don't want her to end up with somebody who's a bum. Who's cheating on his wife and all that kind of stuff. There's actually, we should talk about Deep Focus. Deep Focus.
What is Deep Focus?
Deep Focus. This technique of cinematography where you keep multiple planes in focus at the same time. So you don't just have what's in the foreground in focus and everything behind it is blurry. It's like, it's shot in such a way with enough lighting and the right kind of film and the right kind of camera lenses where everything is in focus, and as the viewer, you can see everything that's going on in all these different dimensions. And there's this it's used throughout the film to fantastic effect.
By Greg Toland.
Yeah, the cinematographer. Award-winning cinematographer working with William Wyler. We see the shot in the bar. Al calls Fred, says he needs to have this heart-to-heart talk with him in the bar at Butch's places. He tells Fred he needs to call Peggy and say that it's all over. And as Fred does that, Fred has to walk up to the phone near the entrance of the bar. Al is deep inside the bar, and then Homer comes in, and then Homer meets up with Al and his Uncle Butch, and they start playing the piano. Homer starts showing, oh, he taught me how to play the piano, and they're playing a version of Chopsticks on the piano. That's in the foreground. We're seeing that play out. We're seeing Al standing at the piano, looking on there, but then he's also looking back toward the front of the bar, way off, like 20 feet away, but it's still in focus. And there is Fred in the phone booth having the conversation. We can't hear what he's saying, but we have to see this short conversation, and then he sees it. We see him hang up the phone and walk out of the bar, and we know that he's had the big talk with Peggy, and so that relationship is over, and all of that plays out beautifully in a single shot right in front of our eyes. We've got a whole, and we're going to have another one of those scenes, the end of the movie at the wedding, where we're going to see multiple scenes playing out at the same time. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So who else? Who haven't we talked about yet? Who's in this movie?
We haven't talked about Homer's girl, Kathy O'Donnell, Wilma.
Tell us about Wilma.
This was her film debut.
Mm-hmm.
But her career was hurt by a studio feud.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So she married the director's brother, William Wyler's brother.
No, the producer.
Yeah, Samuel Goldwyn's the producer.
William Wyler's brother, the director. Yes, that's right. That's right.
And he split with Samuel Goldwyn, who's the producer. So...
Oh, yeah, so William Wyler has this nasty breakup with Samuel Goldman after they finished doing this movie, and Samuel Goldwyn is really mad at William Wyler, and he's also mad at William Wyler's brother, which means he's also mad at, Donnelly?
Kathy
Donnelly, who's married to William Wyler's brother.
O'Donnell,
I'm sorry. And that kind of sidetracks her whole career because she's on the outs with the producer of the studio.
But what a great job does she do being a swell gal?
Yeah. We got to talk about
there's a great scene where Homer has been trying to let her go. He's been trying to set her free because he doesn't think that she can handle his missing two hands. And so when you're watching the movie at the beginning, you see that he has two hooks. You're not really thinking that he takes those off when he goes to sleep.
Yeah.
And so there's a raw scene where his dad has to help him take them off at night and put on his pajama shirt and button it up because they wore pajama shirts.
Yeah.
Back then, buttoned up. And he's smoking a cigarette. And his dad, after his hooks are taken off, because they're on, like, gun holsters, his arms are, he has a cigarette, but his holsters are off, and he can't go to sleep with smoking because he won't be able to take it out.
Can't even take the cigarette out
and
of his mouth.
And so you see how helpless he is.
Yeah. And what a decision. I mean, it's one thing to say, I want to show a veteran in this film.
And have a disabled person play the veteran.
Yeah. Okay, that would have been enough. You could have just shown that.
Yeah.
And there are some people who would say of disabled veterans, oh, don't put them in, you know, like in a parade, for example, and say, oh, nobody wants to see that. But other people...
Nobody, definitely not a leader of a country would say that, right?
No, not a leader of a country. I can't even imagine a leader of a country saying something
especially
like that. But that's
not today, yeah.
Yeah, that's beside the point.
So but Wilma finally... she's finally saying... Homer, I'm not going anywhere. My parents want me to get out of Dodge because they want me to forget about you.
Yeah.
And I don't want to forget about you. So you need to just deal with the fact that I'm not going anywhere. I don't care if you had three hooks.
Yeah.
I'm staying here. There's no, but she's not aggressive like that, so she doesn't say it like that.
Yeah, in a much gentler, yet still firm way.
Oh, she's incredibly kind.
Yeah.
And she's not self-absorbed. She's a girl next door. And so most of the time, when you think of the girl next door and a high school student, because as we mentioned, he wasn't even old enough to drink before he left. So they were young
mm-hmm.
when they were high school sweethearts. She could have been like, I want the next best dress. I want to go out partying every night. She could be like Fred's wife.
Yeah.
And she is the complete opposite. She's
yeah
an incredibly kind person that loves him. She sees him for who he is, and she couldn't care less that he doesn't have his two hands.
Yeah, and as I was saying, I mean, it would be enough. You could just say, okay, we'll put a disabled veteran in the movie, and we'll talk a little bit about, oh, he's got hooks and all that kind of stuff. But no, William Wyler says, I'm going to show this guy taking off the hooks. So he shows us that once with his father, helping him get ready for bed. And then finally, in this scene that's this the climax, really, of Fred and Wilma's relationship.
Fred and Wilma. Homer and Wilma.
Homer and Wilma's relationship.
He's thinking that Fred deserved a woman like Wilma, which he does end up getting, which is surprising that they let a divorcee actually end up happy.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway.
There's another twist.
Homer and Wilma are in Homer's bedroom.
So, yeah, Homer finally says, okay, you want to see what this is like? You come, okay, instead of my dad, you come up to bed. I mean, come to my bedroom. And he explains, this is what it's like. I got to take these things off. And we see his stumps. I mean, and they're not just, they're in the frame. We're looking right at him. And he says, okay, and you know, at this point, you know, I couldn't even open the door if it shut on its
own.
And
if you live in an old home, we live in a home that's built in the 1920s. These doors are not just to where you can just twist the knobs real easily.
Yeah.
And get out.
And yeah, so you're gonna, so she helps him put his pajamas on. And the whole thing is, okay, they're only talking about pajamas, okay? And they're talking about getting ready for bed, but they're also implicitly talking about what is their marriage gonna be like. And it's not just, you're gonna have to help me get into my pajamas. She's also going to have to help him get out of his pajamas. And they're going to have sex with a man who does not have hands is going to be different than it would be with somebody else. And even though they don't quite talk about that explicitly in the movie, the fact that all of this happens in bed and she has to literally tuck him in, that's just front and center. It's like, and like I said, we're not just going to show the disabled veteran. We're going to really put it out there and say, this is everyday life for these people. This is what they go through. This is what their families go through. This is big time stuff. And you can understand where a lot of people wouldn't be up for that. And luckily for Homer, Wilma is.
Oh my gosh, when she leaves and he has that tear that rolls, he just doesn't think that he's lovable.
Yeah.
And he realizes, no, she thinks I'm deserving.
Yeah. And so so then they decide, okay, we're gonna get married. And so let's just go ahead. We'll just kind of fast forward without.
Okay, but I love that they. When did they stop having weddings inside the houses? I mean, how cool is that?
That is really cool.
How intimate, how fun, like an actual celebration, a party. I mean, yeah, you appreciate a good church wedding or an outdoor or a destination wedding, but in the home of her parents, they decorated it, and they have the cute scene where Hoagie's with the children that are going to sing Here Comes the Bride, which I don't know how many millennials know the words to that. I don't know when they decided, you know what, we're just going to cut out the lyrics. We're just going to... Everybody knows Here Comes the Bride, though. They know that tune. And she comes down the staircase. I mean, what a memory for the family to have. And, again, how intimate. Oh.
And I'm not old enough to remember that time, but it was a lot more common to get married.
Why did they stop that?
I don't know.
Because I love that.
Yeah. Okay, but by this time, when Homer gets married, Fred has already said he'll be the best man, and of course, Al and Millie and
Peggy
are going to be there because they've all become good friends, and this will be the first time that Al and Fred and Peggy are together again since, you know, Al told Fred to break up with, or not break up, but to cut off this relationship that was developing.
And again, Peggy actually, well, not again, we didn't mention this, Peggy had so many suitors. I guess she's really popular with the men. really handsome men, money men, and she falls in love with No Frills Fred.
No Frills Fred, but she sees in him she's one of the few people who sees in him what the war brought out of him, which is that he is genuinely a heroic individual who never had an opportunity because he came from this poor family. He didn't have a whole lot of education, didn't have a whole lot of job prospects, but when he was put under pressure where he had to do the right thing and be solid and be dependable and be courageous and be compassionate for his comrades who were killed, all of that came to the forefront. That's who he really was, and she saw it, and she's like one of the only people in the world who sees that this is part of him. Fred goes home. Marie doesn't care.
No,
Marie
she doesn't even care that he's a hero. I mean, also, Peggy and Fred's relationship fast-tracked so quickly, not just because this is a movie. I mean, this is a long movie, almost as long as Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, it's almost 3 hours, yeah.
It's because, she's worked around people who have suffered from PTSD. She comforts him. She's already seen the worst of him. She's seen when he's drunk. She's seen when he's having a nightmare. She's seen...
Yeah. And she's...
But she's... So it's really fast-tracked to where, it's like, I'm still in love with him. So one of my favorite scenes is actually really, really quite plain. But it's when she makes him breakfast after he's slept in her bed, where she slept on the couch, but she's making him scrambled eggs and toast and coffee and orange juice. So they used to make homemade orange juice.
Fresh squeezed.
And they have a personal, like a single-serve glass of orange juice already.
Yeah, well, you gotta squeeze it. You're gonna pour it right into the glass, and then you can put the glass in the ice box, of course,
to
cool it off.
Yeah, but we discussed this. I don't understand how coffee looks so good when they're drinking it out of a saucer in a movie.
Yeah, rattling that cup against the saucer.
And like
slurping that coffee up.
Hearing them have the fork against the...
Fixing that toast
china.
In the oven.
Yeah.
In the oven.
That's what she was doing.
You don't have a toaster oven. You don't have a little pop-up
no
toaster.
No microwave.
No, you do the toast in the oven. Yeah.
No, but that simple...
Yeah.
I don't know, that you just kind of got a glimpse into what they would be like morning after they're married or something.
Yeah. And again, part of the beauty of the filmmaking, the sets are so detailed and so realistic, and it looks so intimate.
And the actors don't seem like they're acting. And one of what they wanted to do with this, I don't know if it was the director, Wilder, or Goldwyn, that wanted it to be like a documentary-ish style.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just incredibly realistic. Which is part of the reason that he wanted to cast Harold Russell, the actual war veteran amputee.
Okay,
in that
what
role.
I wanted to say back to Harold Russell. So I have my grandpa that served, Art Linden, that served in World War II.
Uh-huh.
He had a brother.
What's his name?
Harold.
Harold.
And we looked up, I showed Chet a picture of my great uncle Harold. And
he looks like Harold Russell.
He was actually an amputee as well, but it was from a farming accident. But he was a crewman with the Blue Angels.
Yeah, oh, that's
and
right.
He
that's
was,
right.
He passed away recently, like a couple years ago or a year ago, and he was the last living of the original crew.
Yeah.
So anyway, so I was just like, wow, he's Harold, and he had like a... It looked like he was wearing a Navy uniform in the picture. So I was like, they looked like doppelgangers.
Okay,
almost.
I'm not sure, but I think the Blue Angels might actually be Navy.
Okay.
Because
he was wearing the same uniform that Homer was wearing. But anyway.
Yeah.
Pretty
sure. You got Air Force jets and you got Navy jets and
Yeah. But actually one of the things I learned about Myrna Loy, so she was top billed. Her agent got her to be the top billing of this movie, even though she wasn't really much of a leading...
Yeah,
like,
she would have been... She's more of a supporting role than a lead. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but what we found out about her was she was really active in politics. She did some service with the Red Cross during World War II.
Oh.
So she was a founding member of the Committee for the First Amendment.
Okay.
Yeah, thank goodness for that, especially today.
Yeah.
But Richard Nixon wasn't a fan of hers because she, I guess, really was outspoken about liberal agendas, and so she was a thorn in his side before, I guess, it was cool to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She was the first film star to work for the United Nations.
I did not know that.
So I would have been, I mean, I already loved her. I mean, I'm sorry that I'm not a Myrna Loy in our podcast where I'm charming and witty and just have a great voice.
Oh, don't sell yourself short.
I would have been such a major fan.
She's fantastic, yeah.
And, well, also, this is from TCM. She was a former advisor and officer for the National Committee Against Housing and Discrimination.
Wow.
So.
Did not know that either.
I mean, my gosh.
Yeah.
Charles, what a.
Yeah. And she's just a fantastic actress. I think we haven't talked about her in any other of our podcasts. I don't believe.
No, we haven't.
But, of course, if you want to see the ultimate Myrna Loy performance, maybe someday we'll get around to talking about it. Her first great role.
In The Thin Man,
yeah. She's
We did mention her because we talked about with, from the 39 Steps with Madeline Carroll and her chemistry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But anyway, yeah, just
Where it's like you wanted William Powell and Myrna Loy to actually be married in real life because their chemistry was so good.
Yeah, they're both so witty, so clever, so I mean, and she's just fantastic in that role. She had a long career. She never won an Oscar, but she kept acting into her middle age years because she was so fantastic and so believable as the supportive, wise, clever wife. Companion, so yeah.
Can't she did say. Get a Lifetime Achievement Award and a Kennedy.
Yeah, so yeah, she was fantastic.
Yeah.
Frederick March, who plays Al, did win a couple of Oscars, including one for this very role. Frederick March looks a little, I always thought, a little bit like my dad, just a little. And he is, I mean, because he's not really handsome, but he's just got this really solid look to him. He won his first Oscar for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and then won again for this one. And, God, just tons of great, great films. And he is so incredibly believable.
What's
in this
your
role.
Favorite scene with him and Myrna in this?
Oh, well.
What is it, when they're dancing or in the bedroom? When they're about to.
And it's not just that the acting is good, but this is so,
oh my gosh,
it's so cleverly done.
Yeah.
So they have, the first day he comes home, he's like too scared to actually, that's when he says, oh, let's go out and dance. And really it's just like, let me go out and get drunk. And because he's passed out, they're not going to do anything that night. She just puts him to bed. And he gets up the next morning and he's, you know, hungover and he's like, it's okay. Now I got to think about my wife and how we're going to resume our relationship. And she comes back, you know, he finally takes a shower. She comes back into the bedroom and they're so nervous around her. It's like he's standing where she needs to walk. And then so he moves over there and then she has to do something over there. And it's like, oh, I'm in the way again. And he moves over there and she's starting to get nervous too, and it's like, okay, well, nothing happened last night, so maybe it's going to be a long time before something happens. And so it's like, here, I made you breakfast in bed. And she's fixing up the bed and she puts the tray on the bed.
She's about to leave and you're like, oh.
And then he grabs her right there and they've got a kiss. And the next thing you know, he's sitting down to eat breakfast and it's not in bed. Something happened to that breakfast.
And the Millie special.
Yeah. So anyway, but it's just so
no, but it's also but that
handled.
Even that makes you misty-eyed.
Yeah,
what the heck?
Yeah, I mean it's just such
multiple misty-eyed, but it's not too painful because I mean you have the painful when Homer's with Wilma, that's hard. When Fred and you have Peggy comforting him after his dream, that's hard.
Mm-hmm. And that's another relationship. The relationship between Fred and Peggy is so believable. They've just got a chemistry there. But he is honest with her.
But why is she so honest? I thought, you know, back then kids were not honest with their parents. They didn't have a where we can talk about things. And she talks to them about her love life.
She is just so grown up. I mean, she is so mature. It's like, well, and there's the early on, Al thinks that he's going to have this talk. It's like, you know, it says to Millie, you know, have you had a talk with her about things, you know, and all that kind of stuff? And she goes, Al, she's been working in a hospital the last 2 years. She knows more about all those things than any of us, you know, either of us will know for the rest of our lives. So, no, she's a grown woman. She is the most mature. She is this next generation who gets a whole bunch of stuff. And she can take care of herself, and they just, but she and Fred immediately have this incredibly honest relationship. There is no pretense there. He's not really hitting on her. He's just being on. I mean, when he's drunk, he kind of hits on her a little bit, but when he is sober, he's just frank with her. And then, yeah, compared to Marie. Again, who knows nothing about him and just liked him because he was handsome in his uniform. No, we can see that's a real relationship. And, of course, we're thinking, gee, if ever those kids could get together, wouldn't that be cool? But we won't talk about how the whole thing ends.
Should we talk a little bit about the African-American presence?
This is, okay, one of the things I said about this movie is that I've seen it like 10 times, and every time I see this movie, I see something different. And partly it's literally the deep focus where you can look at any corner of the frame and see something different that's happening there, something in the background, a different character or what have you. And part of it is just the performances are so fantastic, there's so much to appreciate there. The last time I saw this film, I noticed for the first time. Okay, one of the bad things about these classic movies that we love so much that were made back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s is that they're made almost exclusively by white men, and almost all the characters are white, and almost all the situations deal with white people. This movie, at least, William Wyler decided early on, and I noticed it for the first time, he's got one African-American veteran in the very first scene who's just gotten discharged and is also waiting around for a flight. And when Fred is on the unemployment line because he can't get a job, we've got another African-American in that line. There's another African-American woman who's working as an attendant in the powder room. Okay, this is not, you know, great progress, but it's at least a very intentional decision, I think, by William Wyler to say, I at least want some representation to acknowledge that these people went through that too. And when we talk about the GI Bill, which comes up in this film, part of the reason that Al is giving loans to people is because the government has given all this money to the banks, and they've said, loan this money out to servicemen. This is part of how we built the middle class. This is part of the reason that I'm where I am today, is because when my father served in the Air Force and he came back, he got a GI Bill that got him through college, and he got another one that got him a low-interest mortgage on his home, and it, like millions of other guys, the middle class was built this way. But for the most part, those GI benefits, particularly after World War II, did not go to African Americans. So they didn't get to start their farms, and they didn't get to start to buy homes in the suburbs, and they didn't get, for the most part, to even go to college with that money. So that's just something that, again, you watch this movie 10 times and you don't notice it the first 9 times, but that's something that's in there that I thought was kind of neat. At least William Wyler said, I want to have one African-American serviceman and one African-American standing in the unemployment line, because that's part of
America.
Yeah, but
who had more of the influence on the film? Was it Goldman or Wyler?
Well, very much a collaboration, I think.
Goldman, they were both veterans? Or was it just Wyler that?
Just Wyler. Goldwyn saw the story, saw a documentary, and I think he was the one that there was a news story, an interview with veterans who were just coming back, and they talked about how nervous they were. He got excited about that. He commissioned somebody to write a screenplay about it. The guy ended up actually writing a poem instead of a screenplay, but he at least fleshed out the whole story. So the story itself was apparently Goldwyn's idea, the producer, but William Wyler, yeah, was a veteran, and when he was in his 40s, he volunteered to shoot documentary films, and those included getting inside bombers that were dropping bombs and risking his life. In fact, there was a cinematographer who went along to help shoot this, who was killed in action during the film. So William Wyler very much understood what the veterans' experience was, and both of them were just 100% sold on this whole idea of showing that to the American public.
So what's the message of this film?
Oh my gosh.
We'll start with that. What's the message?
There are so many messages in here, but I think for me, it's this whole question of, you know, we go through life oftentimes wondering who we really are. And different experiences draw out different portions of our identity. But when you are faced with the crucible of war and combat and life and death on a daily basis, and this is something that Al has a line to this extent when he's trying to defend his decision to give a loan to one of these veterans who wants to start a farm. He says, you can just look in people's eyes and you can tell who's got it and who doesn't, who you can depend on and who you can't. And I think what William Wyler is saying is that's what's most important. And even though war is a terrible thing, it did, at least for these men, help them figure out who they were. And then the question was, can society deal with who they really are? Can their families deal with it? Can the culture deal with it? And the answer for a lot of people is no. But there are a few caring, compassionate souls who get it and who can deal with that reality and who can embrace that honesty and live with that. And those are the people who really get to live their lives. So I think that's one of the big messages of this film.
That was a message. That was maybe the best message.
Well, that's what you... I mean, how can you watch this film and not think about that?
But why should people watch this film?
And I don't think there's been another... I mean, there are other movies. I mean, we certainly started after Vietnam... We started seeing wars being depicted in much more realistic fashion. And we started dealing with the prospect of veterans coming back home. And in Vietnam, it was even more complicated by the fact that the war itself was so unpopular. And the men who fought it, in many cases, were very upfront about the fact that they didn't want to be there. But, you know, these guys didn't want to be there either. But anyway, I still don't think you're going to see another film that deals with this as well as this one does, the whole psychology of the veteran experience, and not just what's going on inside their head, but also what's going on in the culture around them. So, most of us are too young to remember this time, and very few of those veterans are still alive today. But this is your chance to get a picture, not of the war itself, but of the aftermath of the war.
So, what what's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene, I think, just from an actor's perspective, is when Al has to give the speech. Al has to give a speech to the stockholders at the bank, and he's already had his boss talking, giving him a lecture about how he's being too generous with his loans, and Al is, he is really on the edge of, and actually in the story, he quits being a banker. He can't take banking anymore, and he starts a farm. But in the movie, he stays in this life, and he is just really right on the fence of, can I handle this or not? And he's downed a whole bunch of beverages as he's waiting, and he's called on to give his speech, and he stands up there, and he's tipsy, but yet he's lucid enough that he knows what he wants to say, and he wants to call out the hypocrisy of this whole bit. And he gives the speech where he talks about somebody says to the soldier, you need to go take that hill, and the soldier says, oh, but there's risk involved. What, do we have any collateral or whatever? And he says, and so we didn't take the hill, and we lost the war. And but the message of that story, and he even says, I don't remember what the message of that story was, but he does deliver the message that, no, our responsibility as a nation is to take care of these people who risk everything to be there. And like I said, Frederick March is a fantastic actor. He's a fantastic, incredibly believable drunk. And he also just embodies this whole ambivalence he feels about where does he fit in and who is he now, and is there any way that he can possibly be true to himself and still keep this job, and by God, he's going to try. He's going to do his best. And so I just love that scene. What's yours? What's your favorite scene?
Well, I wouldn't say it's my favorite scene, but it's more from like a nostalgic point, where pretty much any scene with Homer and his uncle.
Oh, yeah.
Like when his uncle's playing the piano, it just reminds me of the have and have not, you know. But just kind of wishing we had something like that, where you have a bartender that's also a pianist and can kind of give some, make you think deeper, have some philosophical moments, and it's just making Homer feel okay.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, you can have it to where it's, you really hope that you would be like Peggy and Wilma and Millie, and you can take lessons from them on their kindness and understanding, but it's also you want to be a hoagie.
You want to be a hoagie.
You want to be a hoagie, so even though you can't play the piano as well as he can and just kind of off the cuff, and but
you know, it's funny, we've got a hoagie and a hero in the same film. And
is that something to do with the soda jerk?
Yeah, we got a jerk.
That
we got
makes
a hoagie.
Sandwiches.
We
yeah.
got a hero, and the question is, what are you? The whole picture.
And I also, with these movies, I pay more attention to what the world looked like then.
Yes.
Like the grocery store, and how it's like, oh my gosh, when they have it to where the drugstore becomes a chain, and just how they have no idea what a Walmart is.
Right.
What is going to happen? They have no idea.
Well, I often say,
what that is going to do.
Yeah, these movies that are set in about this era, we're kind of on the cusp of these huge changes. We have these kind of middle-sized towns. I think of it in Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt.
Which Teresa Wright is in.
Yeah, they really make the town a big deal in that one. Or in It's a Wonderful Life, the way Bedford Falls is depicted. And again, in this film, I watch these movies and I see these kind of middle-sized cities.
And they have, you can go to different dance clubs, and you want that, but not to where it's, you're dancing to what today's dance clubs have. It's like, no, I do want like the Ella Fitzgerald.
You gotta have live music.
I would dance to that. I mean, obviously we can't now, so maybe after COVID somebody open up a Butch's also, to where we have a piano player that can also talk at the same time.
Right. And this is right before America undergoes these huge changes. We don't really have the suburbs. We don't have the interstate system. We don't have huge chain stores. I said before, we don't have fast food restaurants. So we have these...
Well, they talk about how they picked up a tobacco habit overseas.
Oh, yeah. And everybody's
so they have,
yeah.
Yeah. But then Al's wife, Millie, doesn't smoke. She's like, did you forget I don't smoke? But he's been around so many people that smoke how many packs a day?
Yeah. I just got to say, too, I think one of the most interesting scenes, and I can...
Well, my favorite scene is when he comes home and his kids... Yeah. There's no dialogue, but when he stops his kids from revealing that he's home and she's doing dishes, Millie's doing dishes, and that's my favorite scene.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, and that moment of recognition when... she asks, I forget exactly what the dialogue is, but it just occurs to her, and we just see by the way her body reacts, she has just realized, oh, this means Al just came home. And everything has changed, and the world is, alive again for her. But the scene when they're dancing, and he is drunk, and he is so drunk that he has forgotten where he is, and he looks at her, and he sees this really pretty woman that he's dancing with.
I'm a married man.
And he says, oh, yeah, I got a wife from Joe Kittles back in the States. And she
plays along with it.
Right, immediately just says, oh, but let's not think about them now. I really wonder what was going through her head, because
is she thinking this is what he did?
This scene probably did play out, but then again, I sent him off and I figured there was a pretty good chance he was gonna die, and he's alive, and maybe you understand. And there's a similar scene where when Peggy puts Fred to bed and he is so drunk that he's forgotten that he just met her and that he's Al's daughter and all that kind of stuff. And he keeps asking her who she is. And she says, I'm Peggy. And he says, oh, Peggy. And he grabs her and literally pulls her onto the bed with him. And she just says, I'm not that Peggy. And just takes it in stride. And again, you can tell she knows what life has been like for these guys. We're not going to pretend that that kind of stuff wasn't part of the experience. And most films just ignore that. That's, we're just going to whitewash that whole thing. But no, that's part of the transition. That's part of what we have to figure out when we put these marriages back together and these families back together, is life was different then, life was tenuous, and a lot of these guys never came back, and they knew that that was, the ones who did come back knew that that was, every day could be their last. So, anyway, I don't know what else we can say about this movie other than, you gotta see it.
You gotta see it multiple times. So, it'll be on TCM tomorrow night at 5 p.m. It's a three-hour movie.
Yeah, it's on Veterans Day, and if you don't hear this until, weeks or months from now, you can
find it on, I think it's on YouTube, because the Amazon Silk app that we have on our
device, archive,
it takes it to YouTube, and those are still up.
Yeah, so see this movie, enjoy this movie, learn.
Make sure you watch it with your kids, your grandkids, your parents. I mean, I'm going to remind my mom to watch it, because she hasn't seen it, and again, her father served in World War II, so she's going to
maybe learn something about her father that she hadn't thought of before.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe we can all learn something a little bit about ourselves, of what we'd be willing to sacrifice, or have a little bit more kindness and understanding for people that go through different things, or have seen that, gosh, there's a lot more in the world that goes on that's more important than my...
Yeah, our silly, drab,
materialistic,
and...
But it's okay if you're not a nitpicker right away. You just keep on watching it, and you'll get it eventually.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Till next time, bye!